We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 214. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres, Esquire. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am awesome. How are you, Thomas?
You know, we'll see. I mean, we are coming at you from the past, so we have not heard,
right.
I think this is important to emphasize, we have not heard the testimony, but that's okay. We've got plenty to talk about, as always, because one of, I'm not going to say who, but one of us is a talker. or both of us, actually. Who knows?
I was gonna say, I mean, yeah. You know, you literally talk for the well, so do I. We both, our entire right. career is talking for a living.
Sounds like we are talkers, so we've got plenty to talk about. The Q&A just happened, probably, you know, hours before you're hearing this, so I hope you all went and enjoyed it. And we just wanted to give you a little teaser for the fact that we recorded a bonus episode that's for patrons only on patreon.com/law. Andrew, we just had to go, despite the fact that we have a great episode in store for you today, a good old fashioned deep diving into various topics. We had to just get, you know, I felt I owed it to the listeners to make Andrew get on the record and talk about Kavanaugh. do you want to do any teasering for what we talked about, Andrew, in our bonus episode?
Yeah, we went 75 minutes. We talked about the history of how we got here, whether the agreement is binding, how that came about. We talked about whether Brett Kavanaugh is guilty of perjury. We talked about what under penalty of felony means coming from Mark Judge. We talked about a lot of those things. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, no,
really...
there's some interesting insights in those. I'm thinking back a couple of those topics, especially are you might not necessarily know the answer to those. You know, like Andrew, as always, brings some very interesting and unique insight that I don't know is getting covered everywhere. So look for that. We wanted to do a patron only thing. We like you said, 75 minutes. So, you know, definitely a good bang for your buck over there on patreon.com/law.
Yeah. And we're giving away for a single buck. Patrons at any level will get access to the audio. I also want to plug SIO 159, your immediate, evaluation after the hearing, which I think we only overlap. We spent the first couple of minutes talking about my impressions of the witnesses, but by and large, I think they're really complementary, right? Like you handle the substance and the political implications. And then you and I took sort of last minute legal questions from the OA Facebook community. I'm super excited about it. So
thanks very much. And I also will note, of course, we'll be talking about Kavanaugh for Rapid Response Friday. I mean, it's not as though it's all going to be patron only. We've saved a few key topics for Friday's episode, but the really in-depth stuff for this bonus episode. So check it out and keep an eye for Lot Awful Movies. That'll be up very soon, if not already, maybe up. So patreon.com/law.
This is going to be a classic deep dive Tuesday.
A classic deep dive. We haven't had one of those in so long. It's good. It feels good. And with that said, on to our sort of old-timey but still very relevant Deep Dive Tuesday episode.
All right, yeah, get him the hell out of here, will you, please? Get him out of here. Throw him out.
All right, let's take a deep dive back into that case where Trump said at a rally, you know, like, go get him or something like that. And that case was pending. Is there an update? What's happening?
Yeah, this case came down a couple of weeks ago. Full credit to our magpie, Deborah Smith, who sent it to me the day it came out. But Thomas, as you know, we keep bumping it down the whiteboard because the entire universe is on fire. And I didn't want to bump it any further. It's an important case. It's interesting how it came out. So here's what happened. In March 2016, during the primaries, Trump was at a rally in, and let's see if I'm saying this right. This is after my debate, but in Louisville. And
No. This is a Louisville only pronunciation podcast, I've decided.
In Louisville. And a couple of folks went to the rally, which was open to the public for the purpose of protesting. And as they were protesting, Trump from the podium said, "Get him out of here." And then those protesters, including the lead plaintiff, Nwanguma, were pushed and shoved by members of the audience. And they filed a lawsuit in the district court for seeking damages under the under a couple of different statutes, but in particular for the violation of the Kentucky law of inciting to riot. They also sought damages for negligence, gross negligence, recklessness. I have to say, so the first thing I did was I looked at the district court complaint, right, which by and large upheld the plaintiff's claims, and the reason that it did so is a reason that we have talked about at some length on the show, and that is when there is a disputed issue of material fact, or that's what enables you to resist summary judgment, or if there is a plausible statement of the facts that gives rise to a cause of action, then by and large, even in federal court, which has a slightly higher pleading requirement, the courts are going to say, look, like, yeah, we're going to let you conduct discovery on this. And so the trial court really asked two questions. First, they said, does this plausibly state a claim for relief under the incitement to riot statute? And the biggest hurdle there, and I will say I think that the biggest hurdle with this lawsuit was that there was no actual riot. Right? These people were shoved and beaten up, but there was no actual riot. And the court kind of gets around that, and they say, look, this meets the pleading requirements of the statute, right? There were at least five people involved. There was the imminent apprehension of bodily harm. These folks were in fact harmed. And Trump's argument here is shockingly weak on a motion to dismiss for reasons that I just described. And that is, they said that the "get him out of here" was directed to the security personnel, right, and not directed to the crowd itself. So, you know, you couldn't possibly have interpreted it that way. And I think our astute non-lawyer listeners would say, well, that seems like a matter for discovery, right? You know, let's find out, right? If that's the question, if that's your argument, great. Let's introduce as much evidence as we can. And that's what the district court said. They said, look, plaintiffs allege numerous facts supporting an inference that Trump's order to get him out of here was in fact directed at audience members. The complaint describes multiple occasions before and after the Louisville rally when Trump allegedly made comments endorsing or encouraging violence against protesters. And the letter quoted in the complaint confirms that he, this is the security guy, and others, quote, began pushing and shoving the protesters upon Trump's order that the protesters be removed. Sorry, I said he's the security guy. That's wrong. He is an attendee at the rally, right? Moreover, after audience members took matter, and this is really the crucial part because it's going to show you how the Sixth Circuit completely mischaracterized the facts on appeal, which may foreshadow what happens. But the court says, moreover, after the audience members took matters into their own hands, Mr. Trump allegedly stated, "Don't hurt him. If I say go get him, I get in trouble with the press." Presumably, if he had intended for protesters to be escorted out by security personnel, Trump would have instructed the intervening audience members to stop what they were doing rather than offering guidance as to how to go about it. And there's another sort of disturbing argument that was made at the district court level, abandoned on appeal, in which Trump says that in response to the negligence claims that these folks were trespassers. I want to highlight that not because it's an issue in this case, but because it is part of a disturbing trend. And again, we try and highlight when it's true on both sides. This is a disturbing trend almost entirely on Republican politics to declare that their campaigns are not open to the public and are, in fact, only open to supporters. George W. Bush did this. John McCain, he didn't do it so much at his events, but Sarah Palin exclusively characterized her events and vetted folks from showing up who were hostile. That's a core of American democracy, is that your campaign events should be open to the public. And so I just want to flag that, because I've never seen a campaign take that position in print. It's a sidebar issue, but it's something that that I think is really, really disturbing. Anyway, so court goes through that and then says, because we found that this states the facts that could plausibly be viewed as stating a cause of action under the incitement to riot, then we have to look at the affirmative defense of, is this protected by free speech? And notice that that question sits in lexical priority, right? Like, if you have a First Amendment right to do something, it doesn't matter if the thing that you have a right to do is also against the law. It means that the law can't touch you in that circumstance, right? But it does mean that you have to affirmatively establish that you have that right, right? So the burden shifts to, in this case, the Trump campaign to defend their conduct. And here the court will apply a case that OA listeners will find familiar. It's one we've talked about in a number of past free speech episodes. This is Brandenburg versus Ohio. And this is the three-part test for incitement to riot, right? That is, which is also what we apply in hate speech cases. Number one, the speech must explicitly or implicitly encourage the use of violence or lawless action. Two, the speaker must intend that the speech will result in the use of violence or lawless action. And three, the imminent use of violence or lawless action must be the likely result of the speech. And so Trump argued that unless his speech fell into that narrow category, the First Amendment, and he would be right, would bar any effort to enforce the law. But the district court said, look, like, there's an awful lot of intent in that question. The third prong was satisfied because, in fact, imminent lawless action was what next happened, right? People in the crowd beat up the protesters, right? So then the question is, you know, is it explicitly or implicitly encouraging? And did the speaker intend for, well, that's the kind of stuff upon which we need discovery. So that all seemed like a perfectly reasonable result to me. The district court so then said, because this is a question of first impression, we are going to certify this case for an interlocutory appeal. And what that means is, ordinarily, when you lose on a motion to dismiss, we've talked about this before, that means discovery commences, right? That you don't get immediately to appeal losing a motion to dismiss, because that doesn't determine any of your rights with finality. It just says, yeah, they maybe have a case if discovery bears it out. But in rare cases, you can petition the court to take what we call an interlocutory appeal, that is, in the middle of speaking. I think I've got that Latin correct. Mm. And it means what it sounds like, right? That ordinarily the case would go forward, but you know what? Like, we're just going to put this on hold because this is a weird question and we want the Sixth Circuit to resolve it. So went up on an interlocutory appeal. The Sixth Circuit reversed. What they said was that this does not state a claim under the Kentucky Incitement to Riot Act. And even if it did, it was protected by the First Amendment. And the bulk of the court's analysis is that I think a blatant mischaracterization of Trump's next sentence, right? So it is undisputed. Trump said, get him out of here. But then, and this is something, you know, our good buddy Andrew Seidel has pointed out in some of the religion cases, you see it here. Then the court, the Sixth Circuit says, as if it is a matter of the record, that Trump's next sentence is, don't hurt him, right? And remember, this is, again, what a trial court is supposed to do, yeah. right? To say, let's figure out what the context of, right? Because yeah. it certainly is a plausible reading of, don't hurt him. If I say go get him, I get in trouble with the press, right? Meaning I'm being sarcastic, meaning you know, hurt them, but hurt them in a way that doesn't get me in trouble with the press. Mm-hmm. Or I'm just saying this, but wink, wink, you know, don't hurt them. Like it. I would want discovery to figure out what that means. And I certainly would not be comfortable opining as a matter of law. Here's how the Sixth Circuit characterizes that sentence. The notion that Trump's direction to remove a handful of disruptive protesters, nice well poisoning there, from among hundreds or thousands in attendance could be deemed to implicitly incite a riot is simply not plausible, especially where any implication of incitement to riotous violence is explicitly negated by the accompanying words, don't hurt them. If words have meaning, the admonition, don't hurt them, cannot be reasonably construed as an urging to, quote, hurt them. Well, that's the stupidest thing that an appellate court has said in the past month. Because we are all aware of irony. We are all aware of sarcasm. And if this court is to be believed, then nobody could ever sarcastically threaten anyone ever. Right? No one could ever sarcastically do anything that is an offense ever. Because your defense would be, if words are to have meaning, you know, when I said, yeah, Thomas, I love. I mean, seriously, like it is just a preposterous thing to say when the evidence is replete below. When the trial court below said there are lots of different ways that we could interpret that statement. So I'm kind of shocked that this is the result. And so you know what they do is go through
that possibly newly opened Kavanaugh seat of the Supreme Court. Is someone really trying to make a play for that seat?
Interestingly enough, while I have suggested that the next two men who are likely up in line, and they are both men, are Raymond Kethledge and Amul Thapar, both of whom sit on the Sixth Circuit, the two judges, there's a three-judge panel, there's a concurrence I'm going to read in a minute, the two judges who wrote the majority opinion, Griffin and White, are not on that list. So good thinking.
I was going to say the opinion also sprinkles in some like irrelevant stuff. Also, I don't think presidents should have to, you know, testify or be subpoenaed about, just adding this in.
And I should correct. It is Griffin and McKeague. White wrote the concurrence. You were laughing. Remember that what got Neil Gorsuch onto the Supreme Court was his concurrence in Gutierrez Brizuela versus Lynch, in which he said, boy, I'd sure love to be on the Supreme Court so I could overturn Chevron deference. So it would not surprise me to see folks who are auditioning for the Supreme Court starting to do so explicitly in their opinions, dissents, concurrences. I would, in this case, endorse. And I think it's a close call. I could obviously be persuaded to dissent, but what Judge White, this is Helene White, says in concurrence is, although the majority opinion elides salient details of Trump's speech that make this a closer case for me than for the majority and overemphasizes the legal significance of the don't hurt 'em statement, I nonetheless concur in the reversal because I agree that the allegations are insufficient to constitute incitement to riot under the Kentucky revised statute. Given our agreement that the plaintiffs have failed to state a claim under Kentucky law, there is no need to reach the constitutional issue, and we should not offer an advisory opinion on whether, if the speech had violated the incitement statute, it would nevertheless be protected by the First Amendment, thus rendering the statute unconstitutional as applied. I just want to flag that out because, again, you know, we continue to draw the line between conservative originalists and conservative non-originalists. And, you know, that is a common sense. Judge White, I've checked out her record. She has a pretty solidly conservative voting record. I can't say I've read a ton of her opinions, but that's the kind of common sense, non-originalist, limited jurisprudence that I can get behind.
Right.
And I think, you know, she might be right. Like, it the statute, I would have to go through an awful lot of Kentucky state law cases to render an opinion on that. But I am reasonably persuaded that incitement to riot requires that there be a riot.
Interesting.
So I can see reaching the result. I don't think you have to reach the First Amendment, and I certainly don't agree with the Sixth Amendment's characterization.
Sixth Circuit.
So there you go. That's what happened. They can appeal to the Supreme Court, but I'm not going to finish that sentence.
I'm getting a couple different things from you here. So on one hand, it seems like you're agreeing that you need a riot for this to be for that. But on the other hand, you're disagreeing with the Sixth Circuit. So I don't get it. What is your view on this then?
So my view is that the Sixth Circuit is definitely wrong in dismissing this case on the affirmative allegation that Trump's speech is protected by the First Amendment under Brandenburg. I think that is a factual issue upon which, if I were a district court judge, if that were the sole factual issue, I would permit them to go to discovery. Right. You need to figure out what was Trump's intent. Right. What did the sentence mean? I'm saying I think it is a close call if I were on the bench to say, but we don't reach the First Amendment issue because this does not state a claim for incitement to riot under Kentucky law. I think that's plausible. Again, I'm not entirely sure how it comes out. I'm persuaded by both the district court's analysis, which kind of goes
straight
through the statute. Yeah. Go
ahead. Let me get this straight. Is this just due to like the law that they had to use? Because like if Trump got up there and he's his political rally, he's got a crowd of people, you know, behind him, and he says, "Hey, you two guys beat the clown horn out of this guy." He hasn't incited anybody to a riot, so that's fine. I don't understand. What am I missing? Like, yeah, as long as you do it in an orderly fashion, let's not riot about that. Like, let's get in line. Let's take some organized shots at this poor victim. Don't riot about it. Just kind of do it in a tight, orderly fashion. Then you're fine.
I realize that this is one of these, you know, there's no law saying a dog can't play basketball, but under the Kentucky statutes, right? So incitement to riot is a person is guilty of inciting to riot when he incites or urges five or more persons to create or engage in a riot. Okay. And then riot itself, and this is what this turns on, riot is defined under the Kentucky law as a public disturbance involving an assemblage of five or more persons, which by tumultuous and violent conduct creates grave danger of damage or injury to property or persons, or substantially obstructs law enforcement or other government function.
Oh, well, that sounds like it easily fits the, you know, if he's talking to more than five people, so that check.
The five people is definitely met.
Yeah. And they caused harm to somebody. So what am I missing?
And the question is, under Kentucky law, did that create grave danger of damage or injury to property or persons? And I think there's no argument that it substantially obstructed law enforcement or other government function. It didn't do that.
Right.
And here the question then becomes, is that a pleading defect? Right. So in other words, if you say, hey, look, you've got to come back here and allege that there was a riot under Kentucky law, and then you can get into court. So that would dismiss the claim without prejudice. This dismisses the claim with prejudice.
Wow.
This says, no reasonable construction of these facts is going to let you get into court. And I think that's a mistake.
Huh.
Because what happened, right? So let's unpack that a little bit. Here's what they actually pled. The incitement statute does not require that a riot actually occur, nor do the Trump defendants cite any case establishing such a requirement. Okay, so that's the lower court saying that. Nevertheless, the defendants argue that the complaint fails to allege that five or more persons were involved in plaintiff's mistreatment, or that there was, in fact, quote, tumultuous and violent conduct at the rally, end of quote. So that's the question on standing in terms of how you've pled the complaint. And certainly an option, and the option I think I would take if I were a district court judge is if you're going to dismiss the incitement to riot claim, to say, yeah, you got to come back and allege that there was a riot, allege that five or more persons were involved, and allege that there was tumultuous and violent conduct. And then you get to have discovery on that. Then we get to do fact finding. And that means, right, that you technically win on the motion to dismiss, but it's a really hollow victory because they can turn around and refile. Now, again, that also narrows the claim, right? That means that plaintiffs do have to prove that element in order to succeed on their claims. But, you know, they were going to have to prove that anyway in order to get under the law. So that's the significance here, is that you have, you know, sort of yet another example of there is a judicially minimalist way to resolve this, right? A small C conservative jurist would say, yeah, I don't know, right? We're judges. We're not legislating from the bench here. Who are we to describe what Donald Trump's conduct is or what's going on in the head of a presidential candidate, right? What hubris, what arrogance, what, you know, judicial activism it is for us. Let's let the litigants figure that out. Let them have their day in court. Let's go through discovery. To me, that's what small C conservative jurisprudence would be like. So, but you know, I'm paddling upstream on this one. so there we go.
All right. Well, that is weird, and I don't entirely get it. But it seems like it should still be a crime if you direct four or fewer people to hurt somebody. I don't get why that's not a crime, but okay.
Hey, folks, need to cut in to tell you about the great courses. Plus, you know, with all the news about SCOTUS and the fall session starting. Yeah, sure. That's the news. it's incredibly helpful to know the Supreme Court's fascinating and even surprising history. The Great Courses Plus has an excellent course about this, aptly named The History of the Supreme Court. And what an interesting history it is, because it's not as though it's always been this way. It used to be vastly different. It used to be not quite partisan in the same way it is now. There's a lot of interesting history and trends to it. So much to learn in this course. This is an absolutely perfect course for opening arguments listeners to get started with. Or if you don't want to try that one out, choose any from the Great Courses Plus thousands of lectures. And you can do so because with the Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited access to stream their entire library. You can learn about anything from top experts. They have a team of Andrews there to help you with any topic: history, politics, business, science, or maybe you want to learn how to cook or even speak a new language. That could be fun. Watch or listen anytime, anywhere with the Great Courses Plus app. We absolutely love the Great Courses Plus, and we know you will too. And as one of our listeners, you can enjoy the history of the Supreme Court and any of their other lectures for free. Start your free trial today by going to our special URL. Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. That's OA for opening arguments. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. Go check it out right now and take advantage of this offer.
All right, let's move on to the trans military ban. That I have seen that going kind of back and forth in the news. I never know which way is up with that because it's, you know, Trump is... take a minute to realize how bad of a communicator our president is, understatement of a lifetime, but I have no idea what's going to happen or what should happen or what he wants to happen because he's terrible at his job. So what is happening?
Yeah, and this does require some unpacking. So I should add all of these, what we're going to analyze under as if they were executive orders, are actually memoranda from Trump to the Department of Defense, to Secretary of Defense James Mattis, that has the same effect as an executive order for reasons we've discussed on the show. So this broke out on the scene August 25th, 2017. Trump issued his first memorandum, which was a broadly worded ban on transgender individuals serving in the military in any capacity. As soon as that order was issued, multiple lawsuits were filed, and they alleged that that would violate both due process and equal protection of the law. It was that argument was so successful in multiple courts that multiple courts enjoined the effective operation of that letter. the Western District of Washington in Seattle, and also the District of Columbia, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and other cases, and other courts. And as you know, this is your favorite legal standard in the law. For those courts to say, we're going to issue an injunction blocking this from going into effect, required a predicate finding that...
they had substantial likelihood of success on the merits?
There you go. That's right. Right. So not only is it a good argument, it's an overwhelmingly likely to win argument. And part of what buttressed that argument, the first opinion out of the gate, and I think one of the leading opinions, drew heavily on the fact that the Obama administration had previously issued a directive allowing trans men and women to serve in the military. And that was backed by a study commissioned by the Rand Corporation. That study estimated that the medical care for all transgender people currently serving actively in the military would add $8.4 million to the Pentagon's budget, which is not even a rounding error. Studies have estimated the number of trans service members at somewhere between 2,000 and 10,000. And so as a result of that, the Obama administration ordered the Pentagon to lift its ban on the service by trans individuals. So that finding was well documented, and the facts all clearly support that that trans service members are capable of serving with distinction, that there have been literally zero incidents of trans service members causing any difficulty for the military whatsoever, and that the medical care excuse is a rounding error in the Pentagon's budget. So the first effort to block the Trump's trans ban basically said this lacks any kind of serious evidential support. You only need a rational basis, but you don't have one. And so what the Trump administration lawyers tried to do was, seeing that the Obama order was the basis for the Western District of Washington's decision, they issued a new order on March 23rd of 2018. I will link that in the show notes. So this one explicitly supersedes the August 25th, 2017 memo. It says, Section 1, I hereby revoke my memorandum of August 25th, 2017, military service by transgender individuals. And then says, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Homeland Security, with respect to the U.S. Coast Guard, may exercise their authority to implement any appropriate policies concerning military service by transgender individuals. And then says that it will not affect individuals who are presently serving in the military pursuant to the Obama order, but then otherwise is intended to ban trans enlistment in the military. And 6 days after issuing the revised memorandum, the Trump administration went into court and moved to dissolve the previously issued injunction, right? And they went to the Western District of Washington. And the reason you do that is, if you get one court to dissolve the injunction, you can then go to other courts and argue that that court's determination has preclusive effect, right? So that you don't have to litigate the same question in multiple courts. So that's what they did. They went back to the court. They asked them to lift the injunction, and they said, look, like, the reason for issuing this injunction was based on Obama's order. Our new revised memorandum takes into account Obama's order, doesn't affect anybody. So lift the injunction. And the district court said no, that the rationale underlying the issuance of the injunction in the first place was not protecting the reliance interests of current trans service members, but rather demonstrating that there was no rational basis for issuing the memorandum in the first place. And the revised memorandum, the March 2018 memorandum, commits the same fallacy, right? Cites, has the same lack of evidence supporting, contains the same kind of red herrings about, you know, runaway medical costs and, you know, whatever garbage nonsense the right is trying to trot out on their base on this issue. And so they refused to lift the injunction. That was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And I am pleased to say that they've now lost at the Ninth Circuit as well.
Wow.
So first,
I mean, the Ninth Circuit is the most overturned circuit. I don't know. We've dispelled
them. Notice, the Trump administration could have gone to the District of Columbia, right, where the appeal would be heard by the D.C. Circuit, right?
Yeah.
The Trump administration chose this forum. So, you know, take that for whatever it's worth. Well, again, I think because the liberalism of the Ninth Circuit is overblown, and I think their position is so bad that it probably wouldn't have mattered. So, yeah, the district court decision, this is Judge Marsha Petchman, who said that the revised order was essentially the same as Trump's earlier order, would exclude skilled and qualified service members. And she cited additional evidence from the Army's chief of staff, Mark Milley, who told the Senate Armed Services Committee that he had received, quote, precisely zero reports of any disruption or other problems caused by trans service members. So, went up to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit just summarily, they had full briefing on the merits, but in a per curiam order, just summarily said, no, we're not going to lift the injunction. So, again, not a merits determination, but again, you know, we know what that means when a court says that we're going to let an injunction stand. That is a pretty strong indication of what they think of the underlying merits. And hopefully, by the time the merits of this reach the Supreme Court, maybe we'll have a president that no longer wants to defend it. So that's the status. We rarely get a chance to do good news, but this is unabashed good news. And so thanks to our friend and friend of the show, Alice Ashton, who brought this to our attention, and who is a trans service member herself. And so, yeah.
And if
so,
you'd like to hear so about her good experience, news. Check out Serious Inquiries Only from like a year ago or something. I had her on the show to talk about this.
Awesome. So, we rarely get a chance to report on unabashed good news, but good news.
Are we done with this nonsense, or is there going to be another nonsense?
So there's going to continue to be nonsense, right? Like the Trump administration...
brand of nonsense.
Yeah. I suspect that the Trump administration will try and issue a third revised executive order to try and get around this. So, you know, we'll keep our eyes open about this. And remember, as the administration continues to be marginalized, it will do things like this that play to the only base that still approves of Donald Trump. And so we are not out of the weeds in terms of the administration targeting trans people, but we've got a good legal landscape in which to operate. So so I'm optimistic. I'm glad we got a chance to cover it, and everyone, we're puppies and rainbows.
Yeah, a little bit of good news, a little bit, just a tiny amount. That's good. I like it.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
And I love all people, rich, but in those particular positions, I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense?
I won't go any more than that because you're Boy Scout, so I'm not going to tell you what it is.
America's so true.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
All right. Well, it's cool. Again, this is like classic opening arguments. It's refreshing, isn't it? To get to do some deep dives. I mean, still, it's all Trump related, I guess. Now that I look at it, every single thing is still Trump related, but that's okay. It's deep dives about topics that are really interesting. And finally, I got to ask you a question. Can Trump abrogate NAFTA?
Yeah. And this is a more interesting and nuanced question than I had initially thought, right? So set the landscape. And again, you're right. Like even when we do our deep dives are in the context of horrible stuff Donald Trump wants to do. Donald Trump is running around and has been since he has assumed office, claiming that he is going to pull the U.S. out of NAFTA and renegotiate a better deal. And, you know, we have talked about tariffs and trade in prior episodes, but the claim has resurfaced with sort of alarming frequency in the past couple of weeks of Trump saying, well, I'm just going to tear up NAFTA. And so I set out to look at whether the president can do that. And as it turns out, there are two questions here, right? So the first is, does the president have to go to the Senate to get their consent to abrogate a treaty, right? And the reason you would think that that would be the case is because
you
before
need them
a president
to ratify
can,
a treaty, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To ratify a treaty, you've got to go to the Senate. And Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution, this is the strongest argument for the argument that the president has to do that, is Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, and anything in the Constitution or laws of the state or to the contrary, notwithstanding. So unpacking a couple of those clauses, that seems to suggest that validly adopted treaties are, in fact, the law of the land. And it would be weird if the president could just change the law of the land. At least that I think that strikes a lot of people that way. But as it turns out, the Supreme Court has said, in fact, that the president can abrogate treaties.
Wow.
As they will. Yeah. And it comes from a weird source. It comes from the Jimmy Carter administration. And President Carter unilaterally abrogated several treaties. One that was for the mutual defense of Taiwan. And then later, very publicly, he withdrew from the SALT II talks with the Soviet Union. That was the strategic arms limitation talks, both of which were treaties that were signed by the president on behalf of the United States, ratified by the Senate, and the Supreme Court determined. So here's what happened. Jimmy Carter wanted to withdraw from the Taiwan treaty. And then Arizona Congressman Barry Goldwater sued Jimmy Carter and said and raised precisely the argument that I just made. Said, look, this is supreme law of the land. You're just the president. You don't get to do that. And that case is Goldwater v. Carter, 444 U.S. 996 from 1979. So Carter did this in 1978, got all the way up to the Supreme Court by 79. And the Supreme Court issued issued one of these fantastic per curiam opinions. So there's a one paragraph per curiam unsigned opinion that says we do not think Goldwater has standing to bring this lawsuit. And we don't say anything else. And then there are a bunch of concurrences, and it is a 6-3 opinion. So there are three justices who dissent, but the dissent actually goes the other way, right? The dissent is so the per curiam opinion says we think this is a non-justiciable political question. The dissent goes in the opposite direction, says, no, this should be a justiciable controversy, and we should decide that the president, in fact, has the authority to withdraw from treaties, right? So the current law says we're not going to do whatever the president does. We're just not going to deal with it. And again, this is William Brennan. This is the most important liberal jurist on the Supreme Court in the 20th century. This is somebody who, when I was in law school, I think it's still fair to say today, personal hero of mine. Here's what William Brennan said, kind of surprisingly, in his dissent in Goldwater v. Carter. He said, abrogation of the defense treaty with Taiwan was a necessary incident to executive recognition of the Peking government in China, because the defense treaty was predicated upon the now abandoned view that the Taiwan government was the only legitimate political authority in China. Our case is firmly established that the Constitution commits to the president alone the power to recognize and withdraw from foreign regimes. So that is liberal lion and hero William Brennan saying that the executive must have wide-ranging authority to recognize foreign governments. And if a treaty is to the contrary, then he gets to abrogate that treaty and there's nothing he can do about it.
That seems not right to me, but
it seems very not right to me. Yeah. I was not surprised to see the per curiam opinion and the kind of patchwork of concurrences saying, you know, we're just not sure that we're going to let a congressman block a U.S. president from doing something. This seems like a political question rather than a justiciable controversy that should be resolved by the courts. I'm not surprised by that, right? Like, we've talked about the political question doctrine a lot, and I'm not surprised to see the court punt on that. I was surprised to see Brennan articulate a vigorous, full-throated defense of executive power that surely I think he would regret having penned those words today in the age of Trump. But, you know, in fairness to Justice Brennan, an awful lot of people didn't see Trump coming. So, okay, so that
well,
answers
is it
the
a way
first
of
question.
Like, I'm just trying to see how this might make sense. When in traditional normal procedure here, if the Senate were to ratify a treaty, does the president have the ability to veto that just like any other bill?
It's actually more than that, right? So in other words, the Congress collectively passes laws that the president can veto. And right. Because the lawmaking power arises in the legislature, they can override the presidential veto.
Well, yeah, sure.
When it comes. Yeah. But here's why the distinction is important. The president has the power to make treaties. That power does not arise in the Senate, and the Senate does not ratify the treaty in legal parlance. They approve or reject a resolution of ratification. And the significance there is that that there is no, it's not like the veto. Because the power originates with the president, if the president doesn't sign it, the Senate cannot turn it into law. It
All right.
must
well,
be.
I guess when you put it that way, it does make a little more sense for the president to have this power. So I don't know. Maybe this isn't so crazy.
No, but to me, the strongest argument is the Article 6, Section 2, right? Is, okay, once we've gone through whatever the process is, we go through it. It's now, quote, supreme law of the land.
Right.
So how can Jimmy Carter or Donald Trump just say, I don't want that to be supreme law of the land anymore?
That's true.
Again,
okay. Yep. Yeah.
But again, the courts have said, you know what, that's above our pay grade or outside our pay purview, purview or P-U-R-V-I-W.
I like that.
Not,
that was
funny. Yeah, smack
down. We didn't want to buy this on pay-per-view, so whatever happened, we just read about it on the news after, is what you're saying.
Yeah, $70 for, you know, what was it?
yeah.
So, okay, that answers the threshold question. Can a president unilaterally abrogate a treaty? Looks like the answer to that is yes. But turns out not the case with NAFTA, because NAFTA has two components to it. It has the treaty that was, in fact, signed by President Bill Clinton and ratified by the Senate. But then there is also implementing legislation. And that implementing legislation was passed by an act of Congress. So there are now two specific components on this, right? So let's talk about the treaty one a tiny bit, because I want to make sure I've gone down every rabbit trail here. The NAFTA treaty itself has an explicit withdrawal provision. Right. Article 2205, I will link, which says a party may withdraw from this agreement 6 months after it provides written notice of withdrawal to the other parties. If party withdraws, the agreement shall remain in force for the remaining parties. So, OK, well, that seems like pretty straightforward. All Trump has to do is send a letter. But the predicate question that we wanted to bring to the fore was, is it enough for Trump to send a letter, or does he have to go to the Senate to invoke Article 2205? And my belief there is that Trump's letter is probably sufficient, or at minimum, again, the question you always have to ask with Donald Trump, if Trump sends the letter and takes the view that that's sufficient, can you go to court and get an injunction
right.
or writ of mandamus to stop him? And I don't think under the Goldwater precedent that you'll be able to do that. But what if Trump does that, right? So Trump sends a letter in a fit of pique, you know, tells Mexico to go clown horn itself. You can't go to court to have the letter have no effect. What would that do to U.S. tariffs? And the answer is absolutely nothing, and probably make Trump's job worse. And here's why. Because NAFTA was implemented by what began as H.R. 3450, the NAFTA Implementation Act. And so the tariffs that are agreed to in the NAFTA treaty are then codified into law by what is now a valid law. And while the president may have a Goldwater ability to tear up treaties, he can't just tear up laws. You've got to go back to the Congress to repeal that law. The likelihood that the still sizably pro-business majority of Republicans in the House. Look, like he will get his, you know, howler monkeys in the Congressional Freedom Caucus to back whatever he wants. The bulk of congressional Republicans, I believe, are still kind of classic pro-business Republicans. They will not want to have a vote on repealing NAFTA. And I do not believe that a bill repealing the NAFTA Implementation Act is going to make it out of the Congress. And so, so what would happen is if the president tears up the treaty, but we retain the specific tariff reductions that were implemented under the NAFTA Implementation Act, that would create unfair preferential treatment for Mexico and Canada under the U.S. law. And the fact that the United States is a part of the World Trade Organization would give rise to an international cause of action under the WTO, whereby other nations could bring a procedure under the WTO treaty, arguing that they're being discriminated against by the United States. So now again, Trump could withdraw from the WTO as well. Who knows what Donald Trump is going to do. But there would be this intermediate step that would embarrass the hell out of the Trump administration.
And, that's not a problem.
And yeah, right. And bring to a head, right? The only way out. I mean, it's very, very clear. I've been through the text of the WTO. It's very clear that those other countries would have grounds for a grievance under the plain terms of that treaty, right? Which prohibits countries from offering preferential treatment not otherwise subject to valid treaty agreements, right? So, because it's meant to stop, trade wars and preferential negotiations back and forth. So ultimately, I come down on no, Trump cannot unilaterally abrogate NAFTA, but not for the reasons that you think. He can unilaterally abrogate the treaty, but if he does that, it won't affect the tariffs with Mexico, and it will put us on a collision course to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. And I don't think anybody, I don't think even Donald Trump wants that. There is, I will tell you, I have seen this floated. There is the potential that Donald Trump could issue an executive order instructing the Department of Commerce to charge higher tariffs to Mexico and Canada as if the NAFTA implementation legislation had been changed. I think that would then immediately give rise to, we want to talk about, is there a judicial solution? In that case, there would be a judicial solution, right? Because every business that does international trade would have grounds to sue. And, you would have huge multinational billion-dollar corporations suing the Trump administration. And I think that they would have a very, very strong argument that the presidential executive order there was what we call ultra vires, which is beyond the authority of the executive because it would be in an area that is covered by a valid law, namely the NAFTA implementation legislation. So that's where I come out. Trump is going to bluster. We can withdraw from NAFTA. He can withdraw from NAFTA, but he's not going to because of the legal effect of that. And I thought that was super fun, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed this deep, classic OA deep.
A lot of twists and turns on that one. I do want to add in that I mentioned I read the Bob Woodward book, and I think this one thing that's the... I mean, we already knew this essentially, but to really hear the accounts of just how stupid Trump is, like trying person after person trying to tell Trump, hey, it doesn't matter that we have a trade deficit. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, they walk him through. They're like, think about your Trump building, right? Who are the tenants there now? You know, like, forget the 70s or whatever. Like, now it's Starbucks and like Chase Bank or something like that. It's like, it's a service-based economy. That just means we buy more stuff from other countries and we're a more service-based economy. They walk them through it time and time again. The most of the book is different people trying to tell Trump, like, this doesn't matter. A trade deficit doesn't mean they're stealing money from us. Why do you think that? And at a certain point, someone is, you know, quoted Trump as just saying, like, this is just what I think. You can't change my mind. And it's just amazing to think that that's the leader of our country, is somebody, they walk him through. They're essentially, it's like the Simpsons scene where the doctor's telling him about the triple bypass or whatever. He's like, we're going to cut you open and tinker with your ticker. He's like, dumb it down a little bit. Cannot convince this idiot of a very basic economic fact, no matter how many different people try to convince him. So that's kind of at the root of all of this.
It is incredibly strange to me to see this realignment, you know, with pretty much, I mean, one of the only major issues where I break with the, you know, left wing of the Democratic Party, right? Like, we've talked about this before, but like, you know, I think obviously there are strong arguments regarding workplace conditions and regarding.
Right. Oh, yeah. Let me say that. This is not to say that, you know, there's no good arguments on either side. There's good arguments on both sides. There could be reasons to be not a fan of a lot of these trade agreements. But rest assured that none of those good arguments has anything to do with why Trump is doing what he's doing. He is just a moron.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so, I come down on the globalist, internationalist, you know, free trade side because, I'm persuaded that the net benefit of the wealth creation outweighs the harms. But I'm open to listening to sensible arguments on the other side. And the fact that it's been hijacked by, as far as I can tell, ignorant racists, I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling. I mean, you know, the idea of, you know, we would be making, you know, cars in this country if not for NAFTA is just, I don't even know what to say to somebody who thinks that the United States would have a burgeoning steel industry in the year 2018 if not for a trade deal. I mean, that is kind of preposterous.
Also, I have a massive trade deficit with the grocery store. I need to sue them because I've given Safeway all this money and they've never given me any money. I don't get it. Why is there such a trade deficit there? Anyway,
I'm gonna start using that when I do that. Be like, I have a massive trade deficit with the grocery store. That's great.
Yeah, it's
true. Nonsense. I mean, that is the logic. Yep.
Yeah. No. Very all interesting. Right. Okay. Cool. Good old timey again. Trump related, but that's okay. Good. Good old fashioned deep dive episode. Fun stuff. Thanks so much, Andrew, for taking us through it. And it is time to thank our brand new patrons over on patreon.com/law. And we begin with Unholier Than Thou, Malcolm Boyack, Neil Rostant or something like that, Haney Maxwell, M. Buck, Kyle C. Walton, John, that's a tough one, X-U-E-R-E-B. How would you say that? Shurev or something, I don't know.
I'm going to go with Shwerev.
And finally, thank you most of all to Chuck Smith for having a nice, easy to pronounce name. Chuck Smith, I'm right there with you as a Thomas Smith. I make it easy for people. Take it away, Andrew.
All right, and thank you to Rob Doss, Matt Carl, Glenn Firm, Henry Backman. Thank you to Swaddle Buckets. Thanks to Go Vegan for the Animals, Your Health, and the Planet. Thanks to Nick Kruse, to Brett Gardner, and boy, if that's the Yankees outfielder, I will be pleased. and thanks to Nancy Hudak. Thank you all so much for supporting us. You want to support us? Head on over to patreon.com/log. Give us as little as a buck an episode. Come on, you can fork over a buck. You get the ad-free version of the show. You get all kinds of extra special goodies, the kind Thomas has been pimping throughout this entire episode. They're worth it. They're really great.
And in no way did I mean to besmirch the, well, I was going to say the good name, but I'm the hard to pronounce names of the patrons. That's the fault rests with me, not you. Okay. It is time to figure out whether or not I am able to miss a real property question later on down the line, because it's TTTBE. Here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Thomas. Yeah, this was an evidence question. That was a little bit misleading because it turned out to be a hearsay question, and the admissibility of hearsay is one of these things that lawyers really, really study for, right? It's up there. The hearsay exceptions are up there with the rule against perpetuities for creating complicated flowcharts. So here was the question. Prosecutor calls a witness to testify that when the beating stopped, the victim screamed, "I'm dying. Don't let the defendant get away with it." Is that testimony admissible? And you picked A, no, because it is hearsay, not within any exception. So that asks us, is this correctly identifies as hearsay? Is this within any exceptions, right? You ruled out B, no, because the victim was not asked about the statement. That is a good elimination because, and I think you actually worked through this, right? Like that being asked about a statement.
I said it applies more with cross-examination, like if they weren't. That's what I thought they were getting at. Like the fact that if you didn't ask, if no one asked the actual witness, then they can't cross-examine that. But I wasn't sure for, you know, I wasn't 100% if that's what they were getting at.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. And that was, I think, a bad attractive distractor. And you ruled it out.
All right.
You also ruled out C, yes, as a statement under belief of imminent death, even though the victim did not die. And you said, now that seems kind of crazy. I will tell you, I think this is a really, really good attractive distractor. Ooh. It was good elimination because it is not correct. But I bet that some of our lawyer listeners will go for C, because there is a statement for dying declarations. And it is, in fact, the case that the declarant does not have to die for something to be admissible as a dying declaration. However, the dying declaration is part of the branch of hearsay. It's Federal Rule of Evidence 804B2 for the pedants who are listening, and I'm with you. I'm one of your number. It is part of the branch that involves admissible hearsay when the declarant is unavailable. Right. So in other words, you can put somebody on the stand to say Orson Welles' last words were Rosebud. Right. Like that's a classic dying declaration, right? And the guy's dead. Right. Yeah. So, you know, you can put Thomas Smith on the stand to say, oh, yeah, right before he died, he whispered Rosebud and then, you know, dropped the snow globe. But here the victim testified. So they're obviously not unavailable. So it's not part of that branch. And second, I got to tell you, I did not know this. I had to look this one up. I'm glad the question didn't turn on this specific bit of information. The dying declaration is admissible only in homicide prosecutions and civil cases. Totally weird. No idea of that. Would have gotten that wrong if the fact pattern had otherwise been correct. But there's a criminal case for aggravated assault. So maybe it'd be because I'm a civil litigator. Like I've never actually had a dying declaration in one of my cases, but it's one of the things that you're sort of aware of on that branch. So that was our attractive distractor.
Still surviving. You eliminated it. Far.
Yep. And then the last was yes, as an excited utterance. And you said, I seem to recall excited utterances being, something else entirely. And I have to tell you that this qualifies as an excited utterance.
Damn.
Yeah. Federal Rule of Evidence 8032 admits a hearsay statement that would otherwise be barred when the statement, quote, relates to a startling event or condition made while the declarant was under the stress of excitement that it caused. And the fact pattern is carefully worded so that it meets both of those requirements. Yeah. An assault is definitely a startling event, and it specifies that as soon as the beating stopped, the victim screamed, "I'm dying, don't let the defendant get away with it." So sort of classic excited utterance would be admissible.
What's the rationale here? Like, so, is the idea that when it's something stressful like that, maybe the person themselves wouldn't remember or something? Or, I mean, because why don't you just ask the victim?
Well, here, that's right. Like, so remember that the baseline rule for hearsay is don't put on Thomas to say what Orson Welles said. Right. Put on Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. Right. And then all of the except, and the idea is because we believe in the American system that cross-examination is the best way to get at the truth.
Right.
And so you don't want to put on testimony that can't be cross-examined.
Sure.
Many of the hearsay exceptions are grounded in the idea that some kinds of testimony are inherently reliable and therefore should be permitted, even though you can't have cross-examination on those things. And one of the things that is sort of classically held to be inherently reliable is the excited utterance. And I should point out, usually this comes out in the form of impeachment, right? Like, so.
Yeah. That's what I remembered. Case, I thought I remembered a case where, like, it was a question where the floor, you know, the stairs or something bad happens in the building, and the person in charge says, "Oh my God, they didn't get the inspector in on this thing," or something, whatever it was, and they didn't follow the plans, and then they wanted to not, you know, but it was like against their own interest, I thought, is what it needed to be for an excited utterance. But I guess that doesn't have to be the case.
Well, that's a separate hearsay exception.
Okay.
Is statement against interest. And again, the same thing, right? Like, the reason you think a statement against interest is likely to be reliable testimony is people generally go around saying self-serving things about themselves. They don't generally run around saying things that hurt themselves. There's a lot of discussion in the literature, in the law review, about whether, you know, these hearsay exceptions are so archaic that they should be revised or gotten rid of.
Only order to increase my bar exam score.
Exactly. Yeah, it would make a lot of bar exam takers very, very happy.
Yeah, I find hearsay to be very difficult.
So do bar exam takers. So you have a lot of folks commiserating with you.
I want to know who's tortoise won, but first, I guess so this sounds like I have to get a real property question, right? So I've answered, what, 96, 95?
You have answered 95. There are five more, and you got to get all five right.
That's going to be tough. I blew it. Sorry, everybody. I should have just said excited utterance. I think I mixed myself up too much with that, but it really, it's just so hard, because why don't they just have the victim do it? You know, like, just have the victim testify that she said that. I don't understand. Very weird, but I guess hearsay is a challenge. All right, let's find out whose pet won this week's TTTBE. Hop in your time machine. Tell us who the winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, our TTTBE winner is Tom. Check your voter registration, Hale. That is a good message. And he says, D is correct because the last time I was dying, I fought and screamed excited utterances, and the witness is just reporting firsthand experience of the event. Not sure I buy Tom's testimony, but he got the question right. He got the law right. And he's got a socially progressive message in his username. So everyone give, that is at fly44D. I like to think that's a seat number, right? That's a probably the window seat in the back of one of those 757s, at FLY44D on Twitter. Give Tom Hale a follow. Pretty good TTTBE answer. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. That was fun. Classic OA. Classic OA. Good stuff, Andrew. Thanks for, most of all, for supporting the show. Hope you enjoy all the bonus stuff. we'll see you for a rapid response Friday.
Yeah, see you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.